Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Tonight it is going to be an amazing night. We have a very, very special guest, Polly's dad, Mark Klass, will join us. We have lots to talk about with Mark, including his appearance tomorrow on Fox and Friends at 7:20 in the morning. But first, a cracker is a cracker is a Florida cowboy. As we say in Utah, oh my flipping heck, what am I talking about? Here's the deal. Katie Girl wrote a very interesting email to me a few weeks back after we had Dr. Lillian Glass on Trisha's True Crime Radio. We were talking about Trayvon Martin using the term cracker, and we all thought, including Dr. Glass, that the term cracker for white people came from slave owners who used to crack their whips on the backs of slaves. Not so, writes Katie Girl, and here is what she tells us. This is a common misunderstanding and not true. My grandfather is a Florida cracker. Yes, it's an actual ethno-cultural group, albeit a white group from, like, Cajuns in southwest Louisiana, for example, with its own unique history, which is unrelated to slavery. The Florida crackers and Georgia crackers and their descendants are people who came to Florida from Britain and who are mostly cattlemen and women, pioneer cowboys in pre-Civil War U.S. Yes, cowboys in Florida, it's true. Cracker could have derived either from the Middle English word for braggart, and I hope I get this right, I think it's pronounced craic, or more likely as a cultural geographer from the cracking of the crackers' whips to capture wild Spanish cattle in Florida, not for whipping slaves. So in other words, they crack the whip to get their Spanish cattle in order, round them up. They used whips and dogs to round up their cattle rather than lassos. The crackers were generally poor, meaning they were uneducated, they were looked down by most of society, and being poor, they did not own slaves. I did check it out, and Katie Girl is absolutely right. So thank you, Katie Girl. Now remember, cracker has nothing to do with slavery or slave whips, but with poor pioneer Florida cowboys who used to use their whips to round up their wild Spanish cattle and drive their herds. And yes, we will have a test at the end of the show, so be prepared. Tonight, we welcome one of the most incredible men I know. He is so amazing. Not only has he been able to function after the horrible murder of his daughter, Polly, he now spends his days and nights doing everything he can to make sure our children are safe. Mark Klass, welcome. Thank you for coming back tonight. Mark, are you there?
Never heard that before in my life. I'm stunned.
Oh, there you are. You were gone there for a second. What didn't you hear about the crackers?
I said I said you're too kind, and I said that I never have ever heard that there were ever cattle in Florida. So I'm kind of stunned by that information.
It's put me back, and I don't know if I'll be able to continue, but I'll do my best. Cattle in Florida just can't wrap my mind around it. Mark, one thing I have found as I talk to all the people who are interested in true crime, they all know Polly's name. They know the basics about Polly's case, but they're surprised to find out the details of the case, the horrifying mistakes made by the police. The killer, Richard Allen Davis, was seen in the neighborhood lurking. Nobody made that phone call. And I apologize, I don't mean to bring up painful memories, but I'd like to go back so people can understand just how much you have done to get things changed for us since Polly's case. Now let's talk about the killer, Richard Allen Davis. Was he not supposed to be behind bars, or what was his situation?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, this guy had been arrested since he was 10 years old. I believe he was 38 when he was arrested for Polly's murder. He had committed a series of increasingly hostile and violent crimes. They were always sexually motivated. He never spent a full sentence behind bars. He had been sentenced to more than 200 years during the course of his criminal history. He had 38 years old. He found himself back on the street, and absolutely everybody knew what was going to come down. They just didn't know who the victim was going to be. So I think the first mistake and the first, you know, thing that really, really was glaring for us in Polly's situation was the fact that her killer had absolutely no business being on the street, except that there was a manipulative criminal justice system that would put characters like this back on the street time and time and time again. It was horrible. Everybody knew that ultimately he was going to kill somebody. He told people before he got out of prison that he would get a young one as a way to avoid age. Remember, this was back in 1993. And he had been rehabilitated, Tricia. He had been rehabilitated, and he was given a job that in 1993 paid him more than $16 an hour straight out of prison and into a metal shop.
Oh, that
but
makes
it wasn't
me
enough.
Sick.
Within 3 months, he was dead.
Oh, my God. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you're right about him, you know, being seen in that community. And we didn't find this out until trial, but there were people that would see him, and everybody would avoid him. It was either his prison tattoos, his public drinking, his unruly manner, his dead eyes, his just sort of hostile appearance. People didn't want anything to do with this character, yet nobody ever contacted law enforcement and gave them probable cause to come up and question this guy and ask him what the hell he was doing in a town that he didn't live in.
Today, because of your hard work, Mark, and the hard work of others, unfortunately, that are in that club that nobody wants to belong to, the club of a parent of a murdered child, because of your hard work, now we know. If we saw Richard Allen Davis hanging around a neighborhood, I think within a heartbeat, their cops would be on him so quick. I don't think he'd be out of jail today, out of prison. Today, we know we can't let those monsters out because they are monsters. And it's like letting a rabid dog out. You know they're just going to do it again. Why do we have to keep – why do these people have to keep showing their true selves to us? Why can't we see it and keep them locked away? So those are the first mistakes. So, you know, everything in your life is going along. You have a great job. And like you said, you and Polly's mom were divorced, but you were great friends. You had a great divorce is how you put it, which is, I think, a wonderful thing for a child. Polly has a sleepover. And – Richard Allen Davis, the killer, sees his chance. We now know from the trial that he had been watching Polly, and he went in through an unlocked window. Is that correct?
No. Actually, no. He was stalking Polly, and he went in through an unlocked back door.
Back door, okay.
They found his palm print on the window, the window to her bedroom, because he had been lurking out there and watching the girls.
Mm-hmm.
But he came in through the unlocked back door and proceeded to tie up. He conned them. He conned them into believing that he was there for money. And he proceeded to tie up, bind, and gag Polly's girlfriends and then steal her into the night. I guess another thing that never happened during those days, another conversation that nobody ever had with kids was what to do if you find yourself faced with that kind of a situation where you had this sexual predator who was going to isolate you and marginalize you. And I think, and this is what I'm going to be talking about on Fox and Friends tomorrow, that conversation now has to be very clear, and we all have to have it with our kids, that if you're confronted with such a situation, this is real standing your ground. This isn't about excuses for killing somebody. I say that no kid should ever, under any circumstances, go with that guy. And I know that he told those girls that he would slit their throat if they made a noise, but I also know that people like him are absolute cowards. And I think that if they had just told him to go to hell and refused to do that and maybe even screamed to wake up Polly's mom, that things would have been very, very different. So that's one difference. We now have that conversation. But he did steal her, and law enforcement was notified in a very timely manner. But they put out an all-points bulletin that the information was not for press release.
That's what I want to talk about. That's so
shocking.
What does that mean? What did that mean back then? What did that mean back then, not for press release?
They didn't want the press to have the information, so what they did, and I don't know why. I mean, there were no protocols that existed. So every time a child was kidnapped, they would reinvent that wheel immediately. And they would come up with cockamamie reasons for doing what they were doing. In this instance, one of those cockamamie reasons was not to release the information to the press. So one law enforcement agency, the Sonoma County Sheriff, interpreted that to mean that they shouldn't notify deputies in the patrol cars because the press might be monitoring those radio frequencies. Now, within an hour of Polly being kidnapped, two deputies had him in their custody.
That's just so sickening.
Him go because they were unaware of the fact that a crime had been committed.
That I don't even, Mark, just hearing you say that sends chills all over me. I admire you so much because you're able to go on. I would be so bitter and so angry at that. They didn't tell the rest of the force because they didn't want the media to know. Tell me if I've just heard this and it's not true. I've understood over the years that it's because they didn't want a big panic about a kidnapping. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, that could very well be.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
That could very well be. I mean, I don't know what their reasons were, but, you know, numerous kids had been kidnapped in the Bay Area over the course of the late 80s to the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost every year we would hear another story of another child being kidnapped, and I suspect that might be what's going on, but it flies in the face of reason. I mean,
everything
we know now is you want as many people looking for a missing child as you can possibly get, and that time truly is the enemy in these types of situations.
And
so
Markel,
Polly would have been an ideal person for actually she wouldn't have, because unfortunately they didn't have enough information to issue an Amber Alert, but it's exactly the kind of circumstance that warrants an Amber Alert.
Tell our listeners how the police came in contact with the killer, Richard Allen Davis. What did they do when they didn't know it was him?
Yeah, they didn't know it was him. What happened is there was a property owner who lived on a several hundred acre property, and 2 months later she was walking the grounds of her property and she came upon a crime scene. She came upon a pillowcase that had kids that had makeup on the inside. There was duct tape. There was a condom. There might have been a blanket there. And she contacted the same agency, the Sonoma County Sheriff, and said, I think I know what happened to Polly Klass. And there was an incident here the night that Polly was kidnapped. So they came up. They confirmed that indeed something terrible had happened. They looked at the incident report for the night that Polly was kidnapped, and the night that the two deputies had this man in their custody, they checked his name against various databases and realized that Richard Allen Davis, the man they had that evening, had two previous convictions for kidnapping.
And when they came upon... go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, when they came upon him... You go first. You go first. No, you go. You go. You go.
All
I'll
right.
smack you.
All right.
You
all, right. all right. All right. I'm not sure what I was going to say, Trisha. So you go. I have no idea.
Here's what I was going to say. So the police actually, when they came upon Richard Allen Davis that night, didn't they help him get his car unstuck? Wasn't that what they did? Yeah. They helped.
Yeah.
His car
happened.
Yeah. His car had gone
in
a ditch, and they went over and helped him. They helped him.
Well, what had happened is it was a private rural road. I mean, very rural road. There was nothing there. And he had driven his car onto that property, I think to rape and murder Polly was his plan, but he had driven it into a ditch. And the woman who lived there was a sous chef, and she works late hours. She came home. She saw nothing. She sent her babysitter out in her vehicle, a Jeep Cherokee, and when the babysitter left, the guy was in a frenzied state. His car was in the ditch. He was in a frenzied state. He tried to break into the babysitter's car. She went to the bottom of the hill, found a payphone, because cell phones were not ubiquitous at that time, called the property owner, said, you need to get out of there fast. There's something going on your property. She then the property owner called the Sonoma County Sheriff and really had to beg to get somebody up there. They did not want to respond.
Oh my God. She then left.
She saw his car. She didn't see him. When the sheriffs arrived a few minutes later in two separate squad cars, he was leaning against the car. He had changed his shirt. He was drinking beer. The first thing he said to the deputies is, "What the F are you doing here?"
And he basically challenged them.
He basically challenged them. He was drinking beer. He said that they tried to run his license plate. They got the numbers wrong, so the license plate came back as having no problems and not being associated with the killer. And so they then helped him pull his car out of the ditch and sent him on his way. They never thought about it again.
And that to me is lazy police work. That doesn't even really describe it. They didn't care enough that they had a driver drinking beer who was obviously hostile to the police. They just wanted him to get out of their territory and get on their way. I hope those cops were fired
they weren't fired at all. In fact, it's more than laziness. It's gross incompetence.
Yes.
And I made some comments to that end and actually did some blogging about that and received death threats from the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office.
Oh, my God. Who are these people? Oh, Mark, it just gets worse and worse. No wonder that you're out there helping everybody try and understand what's going on. My God, if this could happen where you're at, it could happen anywhere. Rather than admitting that they did something wrong, "I'm so sorry. Oh, my gosh, we had your daughter's life in our hands. We didn't know it. We made mistakes. We're so sorry." They turn around and threaten you. Lovely. Just absolutely lovely. So Richard Allen Davis, they catch him, and he doesn't how did that work? He admitted he knew where Polly was, but they couldn't use it against him. What was the deal?
No. Initially, they had him. They had him because they had that palm print. That was the one thing that they had. But they also were able to tie him to the second crime scene up on Pythian Road where the deputies had him, simply because he had been there, and they had that documented. They were able to put his palm print at Polly's house, so they were able to connect that, and they were also able to connect the vehicle because they found some residual stuff in the vehicle that tied him to the crime. So they knew who he was, and they knew what he had done, and they were aware of his criminal history. And, in fact, the authorities called Polly's mom and I in immediately after his arrest and told us we needed to get used to the fact that Polly was dead. And that led to an extremely contentious meeting between the authorities and myself. Obviously, they knew more than I did at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But
what a horrible!
What
I might
happened,
stop you there for a minute. Might I stop you there?
Yes,
so they
sir.
they just said, "You just have to get used to the fact that your daughter's dead." I mean, was it that cold? Did they just blurt it out like that?
You know what? Cops don't take sensitivity training.
And, apparently not.
I'm not even sure how it came out, but it was like a blow to the head.
Sure.
To me, when I heard those words, I don't know if they were trying to be. I really don't know. I don't know if they were trying to take my feelings into consideration, if what they were doing. But the words themselves are the things that absolutely caught my attention.
Mm-hmm. Right. So please continue.
So there you have it. So what happened then is a local newspaper published the fact that they were able to tie him to the crime scene via the palm print.
Mm-hmm.
And he was still refusing to talk to the authorities. And basically a lot of cops had come in to see him and said, "Well, if you ever decide you want to say something, call me." Call me, and all of these cops did that. And ultimately, a friend came to visit him in jail, and he said, "They've got you. They know that they know that it's your palm print, so they've tied you to that scene." And at that point, he did call one of those cops. He called a cop named Mike Meese, and he said that he had some things he wanted to talk about. He said, I've really effed up. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what happened is he admitted to the fact that he had taken Pauly. He said it was because of a beer and pot-induced haze that he didn't even know what had happened until he found himself up with her on Pythian Road. He first denied that he killed her, but he ultimately had to admit that he did kill her, and that's when the negotiation began. And they wanted to know where Pauly was, and he wanted certain things in exchange for that. He wanted, number one, to be put in a larger cell. He wanted two packs of cigarettes. He wanted a cheeseburger, and he wanted death penalty to be taken off of the table.
Good God.
So they gave him a larger holding cell. They bought him the cigarettes. They gave him the cheeseburger. He told them where Pauly was, and he now sits on death row.
Oh, my God. Let me back up about the police for a moment. You did make some very good friends, though, on the police department. There were some good cops you have come in contact with, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
there were. Well, I'll tell you, Gordon McNeil, who was the incident commander for the FBI, was a good friend. Mike Meese was a very good friend. He's the guy that got the confession out of Davis in a masterful interrogation. Dennis DeWitt, the police chief of the Petaluma Police Department. And I only bring those three up and mention those three because each and every one of those gentlemen has died since then. Yet 20 years later, Pauly's killer sits on death row in California with guaranteed health insurance, something that none of the rest of us have.
Federal I don't have
guaranteed
it.
Health insurance.
I have no health insurance. I am not guaranteed a meal every day. It just makes me absolutely sick. I keep saying that, but that's the only thing that comes to mind. Let's talk about the trial for a little bit, and then we're going to move on. Mm. And I do have some questions that from the chat room and a few other people that I will be directing at you. But in the trial, refresh my memory, did he plead guilty and then it was the death penalty or life in prison? Was that the trial?
No, he pled not guilty.
Okay.
Basically, you have to plead not guilty in a death penalty trial in the state of California. And the trial is broken up into two phases. First, the guilt phase. Based on the evidence, this guy commit that crime? And does it rise to a certain level? And he was found guilty on all counts. The second part of the trial is the penalty phase of the trial. We all know about the penalty phase because that's what just happened with Jodi Arias. They found her guilty of murdering Travis Alexander, but they got hung up in the penalty phase and ended up with a hung jury. So they're very separate. She and he still have to spend at least the rest of their lives behind bars without the possibility of parole. The question is, does this crime rise to the level of the kind of a crime that puts somebody on death row? And after the guilt phase in our trial, the jury announced their verdict. The killer turned around and put both of his middle fingers up right at me, just looked right at me and had both of his middle fingers up. And in fact, that image can be found all over the web.
It's iconic in its boldness and its absolute disgusting manner that he did it. That's one of those things where people, everybody wishes, I think I speak for everybody when I say they wish that they would have just let you jump over that railing at that point. But that isn't when you tried to jump over the railing, when you jumped up, I should say. I mean, you jumped up at another point when he said something horrible, and everybody I know will say, God, if only they'd let him get his hands on him, because you deserved it.
No,
you
that's true.
Oh, God.
Well, that was at the conclusion of the penalty phase, and it was when they allowed first Pauly's relatives, and that included myself and her maternal grandfather, to make victim impact statements. And then for some inexplicable reason, the judge allowed the killer to make a statement. And I say inexplicable because, as everybody knows, the trial is an opportunity for an individual to prove their innocence. He had an opportunity to take the witness stand at any time during that trial and exerted his right not to do so. He had the chance to talk, and he didn't do it. And I don't know why the judge allowed him to talk now. But what he did at the conclusion of his statement, and it was a prepared statement that had been pre-screened, but at the beginning of his statement, he said, "Your Honor, I know I didn't rape that little girl because she said to me, 'Don't do me like my dad.'"
Oh, my God almighty. Why didn't they remove him? Why didn't they remove him?
Well, that's kind of interesting because at that point, people have said, I said this, but a friend of mine said, "Go to hell, Davis. I heard my mother groaning two seats away from me, and I thought this SOB has murdered my daughter, and now he's trying to kill my mother." And that's mm-hmm. when I stood up and made a move towards the killer, but was immediately surrounded by, I think, six or seven bailiffs, and the judge ordered them first to remove me from the courtroom and then to remove me from the courthouse.
Oh, Jesus. Unbelievable.
It is what it is. But it demonstrates what the criminal justice system is all about. It's all mm-hmm. about protecting really bad people. It's all about giving rights to individuals who have absolutely taken the rights from other individuals, or they wouldn't be in a courtroom to begin with.
Absolutely right. Mark, we have a couple of questions here. This one has a happy answer to it, and that is, Polly's friends that were with her that night, do you still talk to them?
Oh, that's really good. I'm glad somebody asked that question.
Yes.
Because the answer is no. I haven't seen those girls for, almost 20 years now, and I can completely understand why they, wanted to put their lives in a different direction. But I found out just 2 days ago, and I found this out because Violet and I are preparing an event for October 1st, which is going mm-hmm. to commemorate the 20-year anniversary of Polly's kidnapping. And what we've done is we've reached out to those girls through a mutual friend to see if they would be interested in attending the event. And one of the girls works in media in San Francisco, and the other girl is a lawyer in Great Britain. And what we found, what we heard, was that the girl that now lives in Great Britain will be in the States during that time, and she would love to attend. And the other girl, I'm not sure about, but what I did find out is that her wedding anniversary is October 1st.
Oh, wow.
So she took what was probably the worst day of her life and tried to spin it and turn it by making it the best day in her life.
So, but the point is, when I said it has a happy ending, is we know both girls are doing, they're okay. They have a happy life, and that's what I know everybody wanted for them. You are still in contact, though, with some of Polly's other friends, right? Don't some of them help you in the Class Kids Foundation at all?
No, you're right. Probably the best example would be Elliot mm-hmm. Groves, who was born within a month or two of Polly, and they grew up together because I was really good friends with Elliot's parents. And I remember I used to tell Polly, I said, "Look," and I said, "Elliot's really a good kid, but he's not the kind of guy you want to hook up with." And I know that Elliot's mother is going to try to get you guys hooked up and get you guys married, because that's what happened with her and her husband. And I said, "But don't fall for it." And now Elliot's like a top surgeon down in Los Angeles.
Oh, see, Dad, you did not give the right advice.
and he's a great guy. Elliot's a terrific guy.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah. We keep in track with some of those kids. Sure.
Good. We have on the phone with us, he is my unofficial official co-host. He's Michael from Minnesota. And I know he's been anxious to ask you and talk to you for just a moment. So, Michael, I'm going to turn the floor over to you for a moment with Mark Glass.
Hi, Tricia. Thank you so much. And, Mark, what an honor and pleasure and privilege it is to hear you and hear your story. I spent all day reading links that Tricia was kind enough to send me, and my heart goes out to you for the horror that was Polly's final day on this earth. I can't even imagine a father going through what you've been through. I was reading your blog, and something that really struck me was a piece that was written about the constitutional rights given to these criminals that is not afforded the victims. Is there anything, I know that they told us to contact our state representatives and try to get this changed. Is there any way, can we get a movement going where that could change, where the victim does have more rights than the perpetrators of these crimes?
Sure. The only way that we'll ever have, the only way that victims will ever have equity in the criminal justice system with the perpetrators of crime is through the passage of a constitutional amendment, a United States constitutional amendment that affords rights to victims. Because if you look into the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution, they afford a whole list of rights to individuals who are accused of having committed crime. But the word victim absolutely doesn't exist. So whenever there's any kind of a push and shove between who's got rights and who's doesn't, you go right to the Constitution, and the Constitution is very clear. If you've been accused of a crime, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. You have the right to a fair and speedy trial. Yet the victims of crime have absolutely none of those rights. So there was a good movement back in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, to get a constitutional amendment for crime victims. It was supported by President Clinton. It was then supported by President Bush. It was supported by many members of Congress, but not nearly enough.
How is that possible? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think that there's a lot of defense attorneys that we elect to Congress, and attorneys have a huge lobby, and crime victims don't have a huge lobby. So you can get any of a number of attorney lobbies going to various the lobbies have lobbyists. The lobbyists are there to influence legislation. They know where to go. They know who to see. And they have their finger on every sitting congressman and senator on Capitol Hill. And victims just don't have that kind of pull. So it's not about doing the right thing. It's about doing the – it's about taking care of your clientele.
Oh,
and whereas congresspersons and senators should be representing the people in their districts, oftentimes, and we see this all the time, we see why nothing gets done in Congress, is they represent special interests instead, whatever those special interests might be. And there's an awful lot of them that are very, very well financed, but none of them are victims of crime or common people. So
amazing.
Can it get done? Will it get done? I have absolutely no idea. But I know that every opportunity and every effort to do something about that in the past several years has gone absolutely no place. But that being as it is, nothing will change until we get that amendment to the Constitution.
It's got to happen. I think it needs to be put on a ballot. I cannot imagine the population would not be 100% such an amendment.
Well, what you need is you need ratification. You need two-thirds of both houses of Congress to pass it, and then it needs to be ratified by, I don't know, two-thirds of the states or three-quarters of the states. I'm really not up on my constitutional
law. I think
law.
It's two-thirds. I think it's two-thirds.
It's not an easy thing to accomplish, and it shouldn't be an easy thing to accomplish.
Right.
We shouldn't have the ability to amend the United States Constitution very easily, but certainly there are times, because things do change, and there are times in history when we do have to make those adjustments, and I agree with you. I think this is the time for this.
Absolutely, especially having witnessed the Arias trial, where that particular thing or person or whatever evil it is was able to drag her victim completely through the mud with unsubstantiated claims of the most horrific kind, pedophilia and battery. It astounds me. So the passage of such a bill to protect the rights of victims, it's just mandatory. It seems like it's got to happen to me.
Well,
boy, everybody says it, you know, but I mean, I don't even know where to begin. It's just such a hard
either,
thing.
I don't either, but I want to help. I want to do something. So that's why I was hoping I could
contact your congressmen and your senators and ask them how they would vote on that.
They better have
really,
the right answer.
That's where it starts. Well, but they, you know, they may say one thing, and then when push comes to shove, say, well, gee, I really wanted to vote for that amendment, but it had, you know, it changed the balance of justice or whatever,
something,
you know?
Stupid.
Or something. Right.
Michael, we do need to move on because I've kept Mark talking too long. I do have some other cases, but we're going to come back to you in just a little bit. And unless, Michael, you have a pressing question that you just need to get out.
Well, I'm anxious to move the conversation along, too, as far as the change in the three strikes law and all that, I'm assuming is where you're going to go. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, lots more to talk about. So yeah. I'm all in here.
And, you're good to go. And then we're going to talk about Brittany Wood, because Brittany Wood, that's a case that the Class Kids Foundation and the Class Kids Search Center is involved with. And Mark, I know you have plans for tonight, so we'll try and move it along. It's just that you're so darn interesting. We could just listen to you all night. Well, I'm serious. We could listen to you all night long. Let's talk about the three strikes law. What a great law. And people have it confused. They think that if somebody steals a Snickers bar, they can get sent away for life. Explain how the three strikes law works and how there is room for the judge to decide something and how well it worked. Let's talk about what it did and how well it worked, and then we'll talk about what's happened since then.
Yeah, sure. The three strikes law is an intriguing piece of legislation that was passed in the aftermath of Polly's tragedy back in very early 1994. And basically what it said is that in the state of California, if you have two serious or violent prior convictions, then your third conviction, whether it's serious, violent, or even a what one might call a wobbler or a petty crime, can land you in prison for 25 years to life. And that basically they're looking at the totality of your criminal history as opposed to the last crime that you committed. So it's basically you didn't learn the first time, you didn't learn the second time, you know that you're faced with 25 years to life, yet you still decide to commit a crime. Well, goodbye for you. We'll see you later. Mm-hmm. And it helped to decrease crime dramatically in the state of California. The interesting thing is that there were a lot of predictions that we would have to build 25 new prisons, that it would bankrupt the state, and that higher education would no longer be available in the state because all resources would be going towards housing a population of aging offenders. What did happen instead is that between now and then, in the 5 years prior to three strikes, California built 9 new prisons. In the 20 years since three strikes, California has only commissioned and built 1 new prison.
Wow.
That the prison population went up, but it's hovered consistently over the course of the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is definitely above capacity. There's no question about that. The prison population at its height in California was 178,000 offenders in a system that was really equipped to hold maybe half that many. But the three strikes population never exceeded 9,000 individuals in the state of California. Never exceeded 9,000. That's 6.6% of that total prison population. So it worked exceedingly well. It got certain parolees to move out of California. That was one demographic shift in the state of California. It took a small population of serial offenders and put them behind bars for 25 years, and crime started to go down dramatically in California as a result of that.
I think it worked on every level.
They got the bad guys.
True, they got the bad guys. It also gave prosecutors the ability to use their discretion on whether or not the justice was furthered by charging somebody with the third strike. So they had discretion. The judge also had discretion to drop a strike so that if somebody he felt didn't belong in prison for the rest of his life, would then get another chance as well. And it worked exceedingly well throughout its history, but unfortunately the voters voted it out just last November.
Tell us what happened. How were they lured to think that three strikes was a bad idea?
Well, they were sold a bill of goods. They were told that there was a huge aging population. They were told that it did not fulfill its original intent, that it should only apply to individuals whose third strike is a serious or violent offense.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there was this aging population that was bankrupting the state of California. But you know, it had a lot of money behind it. The proposition to overturn three strikes had a lot of money. The opposition to maintain the status quo of three strikes had absolutely no money. Therefore, it passed. Now, the irony of this is that the money behind the effort to overturn three strikes all came from out of state, and the individuals who wrote the three strikes amendment or the effort to overturn three strikes were a bunch of academics from Stanford University. Now, I say that's ironic because nobody ever gets paroled to Palo Alto, California, or to Stanford University. So these guys don't even have a dog in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
They don't.
These guys don't even have a dog in this fight. So they were able to overturn it. They're now on the verge of letting, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 of these really bad guys back out onto the streets with very little effort to assist them or help them in any way.
Right.
And we'll just see a new crime wave. We'll just see a new crime wave in California. It's inevitable.
And hopefully you will be there to point it out. I know you don't want to gloat and say I told you so, but I think it's important that the people of California know that they were sold a bill of goods by these ridiculous, you know, people from Stanford, for God's sakes. I love how people who would have absolutely no chance of having a paroled sex offender or a paroled violent offender move into their neighborhood, how they would love to come in and change the laws because somehow they know better than the rest of us, you know, little people beneath them. It just repulses me. Michael in Minnesota, do you have a question?
Well, that brings me to another thing I noticed in my reading today. This Canadian group that has sponsored these death penalty inmates and has a web page actually set up for the murderer in Polly's case. What in the world motivates people to reach out and assist the worst of the worst? Davis, I had also read, bragged about dousing animals with gasoline and setting them afire. I mean, this is a depraved, sick human being that doesn't deserve anyone's attention. There's so many worthwhile causes. What are they thinking by getting behind someone like this? I can't, for the life of me, fathom it or understand it.
Mark,
I don't understand it either, Michael, and I'm completely and totally aware of this group that you're talking about. I'm completely aware of who these people are. I, too, find them totally and 100% loathsome. I think they have absolutely no business sticking their finger into American affairs because they are Canadian, after all. And there's very little that can be done to take them down. I guess they've got their right to free speech. Why would somebody do that? Let me tell you, during the last election cycle, I was involved in a couple of propositions that were on the ballot, and one of them was a death penalty proposition. There were people trying to overturn the death penalty in California, and just like with the three strikes proposition, this was funded by people from out of state, and it was written and supported by professors from Stanford University. And I went to a debate. I was participating in a debate, in fact, on two different propositions. But there was a professor from Stanford there debating, positioning himself as to why we should overturn the death penalty in California. And at one point, in very heartfelt terms from the podium, he said, "They are our sons, they are our daughters, they are our community." And he said it in a very heartfelt way about death row inmates. Now, the
Not
thing
mine.
That I thought was really, the thing that was really interesting about this particular incident is that after he was done, and I was sitting in the audience at this point, after he was done, and he knew exactly who I was because he even quoted me at some point during his presentation, he went and sat down behind me, and as soon as the whole thing was over, he got up and ran away. And I thought, you know what, this guy feels empathy and sympathy for these death row inmates. He feels they're his brothers and sisters and sons and daughters. They're his community. But he couldn't even walk up to me and tell me he was sorry that my daughter had been murdered. And I thought, what kind of priorities do these people have? Exactly what is it that makes them feel so much sympathy and empathy for these hideous, horrible, subhuman individuals that are sitting on death rows throughout our land?
I have two answers to that, Mark. I know that's a rhetorical question, but I can answer in two ways. First of all, that guy that made that speech has never, ever had anybody close to him killed or brutally murdered or brutally raped or brutally attacked by one of these so-called brothers and sisters. I can guarantee you that. It's real easy to sit back in your armchair and say, well, you should have compassion for them. You've never gotten down in the mud and rolled around with these criminals and these freaks and had to deal with the court system. So it's real easy to get on your high and mighty holy horse and pronounce they're your brothers and sisters. And also what Michael brought up about the people in Canada who have these websites for the death row killers here in the U.S., there is an element out there that will do anything to get attention or to have a brush with fame, if you will, even if that fame is something horribly negative, like a serial killer. It will be there. They will feel like their life has meaning now, and it's a way to kind of get famous. They might get interviewed by a magazine. Hey, maybe even a TV station might come and talk to them. It's a way for them to grab on to the coattail of fame, even though that coattail of fame is attached to a brutal killer. I think those two things play together, and that's where you have this group of people on one end telling us that these people are our brothers and sisters. They're not mine. They're not my community. I'll tell you that. And the other is the people who just need a little bit of fame and a little bit of quote-unquote love in their life.
But,
I don't know. That's just my two cents.
It goes beyond that because there's also a political motivation involved. There truly are people out there who believe that every crime that's committed is committed because society somehow let the criminal down. Mm-hmm. So it's almost the exact opposite of taking responsibility for your own actions. Allen Davis murdered Polly Klaus because Richard Allen Davis didn't get enough hugs from his father when he was 8 years old. And they, for some reason, really seemed to believe in that. And for the life of me, I don't understand how or why, but it seems to be a very political reality. And basically, it's, you know, well, enough about that.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, come on.
Yes.
Spit it out, Mark. What were you going to say?
Well, listen, what I was going to say is that, you know, what you have in that situation, that mindset is a very sort of democratic, liberal mindset.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, everybody should have welfare. Everybody should be on food stamps. That, you know, there should be, regardless of who you are or what you've done, there should be some safety net available to keep you standing on your feet. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can be whatever you want to be in society, and they're going to be there to catch you and prop you back up. Therefore, you don't have to take responsibility for your own actions in any way, shape, or form. You can say, they can say, well, I'm a sex offender, and I've raped all of these little kids, but it's because I was raped when I was a little kid, right? Mm-hmm. Or daddy didn't give me enough hugs, or mommy was a drunk. So it's not my fault, it's society's fault.
Right, and that's ridiculous. As we know, that is absolutely ridiculous. Co-host officially now, Michael, thoughts?
Well, talking to a liberal Democrat,
well,
I am not one of those people. I, however, am of the mindset that there are plenty of very worthwhile causes that these people could be attending to if they were feeling so magnanimous that they wanted to get behind something.
Mm-hmm.
But to defend the indefensible is certainly not worthwhile, in my humble opinion. I just find I'm aghast by it.
Me
but
too.
But it's a constitutionally guaranteed right.
It's ridiculous. I hate
Absolutely. Now, I'll tell you what, let's move on to a case that if you think your teeth are on edge now because you're thinking about stuff, wait until you hear this bizarre family. And this is a family and a case that the Class Kids Search Center, Brad Dennis and the gang, they've been involved with trying to find missing 19-year-old Brittany Wood. Now, listen to this, people, okay? Are you ready? Chessie Wood is the mother of Brittany Wood. Brittany's been missing since May 2012. Chessie was recently arrested on two counts of sodomy and one count of sex abuse of a child under 12 years old. Investigators say the child was 10 at the time of the alleged incident. The alleged victim is now 14 years old. This is Brittany's mother, her mother. Now, her mother joined six other suspects, including her son, brother, and sister, who are charged in an alleged child sex abuse ring spanning Mobile and Baldwin counties. But let's jump back to May 2012. Brittany Wood, 19, was going to her Uncle Donnie's house, although Brittany's mother, Chessie, said she was actually going to her friend Courtney's house. Brittany's phone last pinged closer to Uncle Donnie's house. That is May 2012. June 1st, 2012, Uncle Donnie commits suicide. Uncle Donnie commits suicide with Brittany's gun. That's where I just stopped and I said, I'm going to let Mark take it from here because I don't want to read anymore. My brain will explode. What's going on, Mark? What do you know?
Well, I've actually met Chessie. I've met many of the members in the family during a trip down to Pensacola, which is about 45 miles away from Mobile. And it's a really tragic situation. It almost looks as though Brittany didn't have a chance in life. There is so much dysfunction of almost every type. I mean, this is a family that's heavily involved in drugs, in various sexual crimes, including incest, that basically, as you can see, it's not only the mother and the uncles, but it's Brittany's brother is involved in this. And this girl, my belief is that, and I think this is borne out by some obvious facts, is that she was murdered by the uncle.
Yeah.
And that for whatever reason, the uncle then took his own life rather than face the possibility of being accused of that crime. And my belief is that given the fact that they've had so many searches over the course of the last 15 months, is that probably this case will never be solved.
Mark, we've all heard of the... Sometimes, let's face it, there can be a witch hunt, especially when it comes to sexual abuse. We've seen it happen where there's a hysteria that prevails. I don't know enough about this case, but is it possible there's a bit of that going on here? Is it really, truly this big family of sexual deviants hurting small children? I mean, is that really, that's the really hardcore truth here?
I'm not privy to any law enforcement information,
mm-hmm.
but I think there's truth to the charges.
It seems like there is, and I just, you know, in the other cases, they were always so iffy, and it was so bizarre, and, you know, we're talking about the, oh my gosh, I can't remember, the big child care case in the 80s in California.
The McMartin case.
I mean, right, you know,
yeah.
If you read those statements, you're like, oh, come on. This seems to have a lot of teeth to it, and you're right. It does seem like Brittany Wood came from a horribly dysfunctional family. There are people that think maybe she might be in some sort of sex ring. You don't think that's a possibility, though?
Oh, I think anything's a possibility. I
mm-hmm.
mean, you know, that this is one of those situations where that would be the best-case scenario.
Yeah,
that she
be
is
alive.
Involved somehow. That she is exactly involved somehow with the sex trade. I think it's possible, but that doesn't explain the uncle committing suicide.
Yeah, that's very bizarre. That is that. Why else would someone commit suicide unless they had a guilty mind of something? And it was shortly after Brittany went missing. She was a single mother. And she's just a beautiful, beautiful lady, young woman, just ready to start out her life. But this case has really sparked the interest of a lot of people on Web Sleuths and a lot of people around the world because of this bizarre. It's so foreign to everybody to think that a family like this, the uncles and the brothers and the sisters and the mothers, are all into this deviant sexual thing. It's just beyond comprehension. It's really hard to comprehend. And go ahead, Mark.
No, I wasn't going to say anything. I agree with everything you're saying.
But how you've been out on several searches. How many? You've done quite a few, actually, haven't you, for Brittany?
Yeah, you'd have to ask Brad that.
Okay.
But yes, they have done a lot of searches for Brittany. There's no question about it.
And
they
do you
unfortunately keep coming up. They keep coming up empty.
And do you plan on doing any more searches in the near future that you know about?
Oh, I don't know. I think at this point in time, the only reason that they would do a search is if new information shows up that would lead them to a specific location, because they really did look at all of the locations that were warranted early on. They've been
mm-hmm.
returned to the field several times since then when new information warrants it. And I think that that's kind of how this is going to have to move in the future.
Do you think maybe somebody else in the family knows more than they're saying? I know that's an odd question, but I'm hoping the uncle said something to somebody before he died.
Oh, I have no idea.
I'm hoping.
Who knows? You know,
Mark,
I have no idea.
You met Chessie, you said. What was your impression of her, may I ask?
Well, my impression of all of the family members I met was that they're dirt poor, uneducated people. That they're dirt poor, uneducated people.
That's
much like
bad.
The Haley Cummings and
well, yeah, you know, the same ilk. Yeah, sure. And
the Haley Dunn.
If in fact the drugs and the sexual allegations are true, then you know it's beyond being dirt poor and uneducated. It's also about drugs and deviant sex.
Sickening. Mark, I'm going to throw out a curveball here. This isn't a topic I told you about, but I just thought about it. You've commented on Mark Redwine before, correct?
Who's he?
He is the, I'm sorry. There's so many cases, so little time. He's sorry, I should preface
that. Oh,
yeah.
That was
his son.
His son. Yeah, little boy, Dylan.
Yeah.
Dylan's father.
Right, Dylan's father.
Yeah, sure.
Let me just tell you briefly, he's been on my show several times, and every time he's on the show, he talks a lot, and I just recently read a text that he sent Elaine, And it was the day that Dylan was found, and I can't even repeat it. It was so horrible and so awful, and I don't want to have him on my show again after that. It really made me sick. I can't say for sure if he's hiding something, but he said that the police told him he failed miserably, his polygraph. He told everybody, and while he was on my show, he told everybody, don't search Middle Mountain, no need to search Middle Mountain, which is exactly where they searched and found Dylan's remains. What was your impression of him?
Well, I mean, I haven't revisited that case in a long time, but didn't the little boy disappear almost immediately upon arriving in town
from
his mother's house?
Well, supposedly
it was the next morning. A court ordered
right.
visitation. He got off the plane, went home with the dad, and then said he was going to hitchhike or something down to another location.
No,
I don't believe.
Go ahead.
Go on.
I was going to say his dad. Here's what his dad said. see if you can pick up on this because even I picked up on it. So if I can pick up on it, anybody can. He said he was, Mark said he was irritated and kind of annoyed, and those are my words, basically, but he was irritated that Dylan's plane was late. And then Dylan didn't want to go to a sit-down restaurant. He wanted to go to McDonald's. And then they had to go to Walmart. And then they went home, and I think he said that Dylan didn't want to watch the movie he wanted to watch. And I said to him, I said, boy, it sounds like you were getting pretty irritated as the night went on. And he said, oh, but, you know, that's just boys, you know, that's just Dylan, that's his age, he was just being moody, I understand this. But I felt that there was this pressure building up in the night, you know, as the night went on. And Mark said he got up in the morning, and when he came back from running some errands, Dylan was gone. His backpack is gone, everything he brought is gone, I believe. And the last text he sent was at 9:37 the night before. And nothing on his cell phone, nothing. And I've told Mark that I don't know if he's innocent or not, and that I have problems with some of the things that he has said. Well, especially now when I read that text, it was just a horrible, horrible text the day that their son was found missing. I mean, the day the son's remains were found. And yes, the mother, Elaine, has had her share of, it's been back and forth. It has been very ugly. But I don't know. I just wanted to know your impression of him. Would you advise him to, here's the other thing. He wanted to talk to you to get advice. And I told him, I said, I think the advice Mark would give you is probably to take another lie detector test. Would that be what you would tell him to do?
Well, my advice is always to keep open lines of communications and cooperate with the police.
And he has been cooperating. The police have said cooperating fully, so he has been.
Well, then the next step from that is that you have to clear yourself from suspicion. Because after all, he's the father of the child, and he's the last person to see the child alive. Therefore, people are going to continue to look at him until he is cleared as a suspect in the case. And I don't really want to say anything more about it because I just am not that well versed
on
this
fine.
Case.
But I do want to ask you about your situation with Polly. You were put through the ringer, if I remember correctly, because they wanted to make sure that you were not involved with Polly, right? And you were right there on their doorstep saying, do whatever you have to do.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And they were, you know what, they were really clear. The authorities said, we're going to look at you, you're a suspect, she's from a broken home, she's, you know, living with her mother and she visits with you, and in these types of situations, you know, in the vast majority of instances, parents are involved, non-custodial parents are involved, so it's up to you to make sure, you know, to clear your name, and I said, let's do it, whatever it takes, let's do it. And they had me hooked up to the polygraph not long afterwards.
And you passed, right?
It was intimidating. Nobody wants to be hooked up to a lie detector machine, quite frankly, but, you know, you do what you have to do sometimes.
And
yeah,
I know
I did it and was cleared
pretty quickly.
Okay, and I know you don't have much time left. We do have one more case we want to go over if we can really quickly. Do you have just a few more moments?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. This is a case of a missing one-year-old, and she's just adorable. Elena Steinfurth, she's been missing since early June. Her mother, Angela, was arrested for child endangerment, and that was dropped, and now she's charged with obstruction of justice. And here's the story. This is what we know. Elena Steinfurth's father, Terry, went to pick her up from her mother's house for a visitation. At first, Angela refused to give Terry the baby. She went back in the house, then came back out and said, oh, wait, the little girl's missing. It's such a bizarre, weird story. It sounds like the theory is floating around that there is a family, not a family member, but somebody close to the family, perhaps her boyfriend, harmed her. Now, they have found hair in the river close by them, and it is human hair, and they're waiting to see if it's Elena's hair. Those tests will take several weeks. Are you familiar with this case?
Yeah, I am.
And tell us your thoughts. Tell us am I missing anything here? What's going on?
Well, what you neglected to mention is that when she went back in to get the little girl, she was in there for 20 minutes before she came out and said that she was missing.
I guess
the question, and the question has to be asked, why did it take you 20 minutes to figure out that she wasn't where she was supposed to be?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, this is another case where the last people to see him, the mother and the mother's boyfriend, have not been able to clear themselves from suspicion, and it therefore becomes very difficult to move this to another level and to expand the investigation as long as the finger continues to be pointed at these two people.
Right.
And, there were also some very real suggestions that the little girl was injured the day before. And I know that there's some video out there of the mom with the little girl, and people have noted that she seems listless, that she seems to, almost be in a semi-comatose kind of a situation. And the mom hasn't been able to make amends with any of that. So,
I've seen that video.
I was watching it a little while ago. So, mm-hmm. Sure, she'd prefer to sit in a prison cell than talk about what actually happened here.
Mm-hmm.
This is another case. I don't know. I don't think the chances of finding this little girl alive are very, very good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty clear that there are people that know what happened and that those people have decided to keep their mouth shut.
They learned from Casey Anthony.
I'll say.
Well, there you go. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, how do you do it every day? I've watched you over the years. We've known each other for, 10, 11 years now, and I've seen you get up, 3, 4 in the morning, and you're still going late at night trying to get it out. I don't know how you do it. How do you do it? How come
Violet,
you just don't? Go ahead.
Violet stands behind me with a whip.
Well, that's good. Somebody needs to.
Listen, you got to do something. Listen, we decided a long time ago that we were going to begin this kind of advocacy because nobody else was really doing it. Really, nobody else seemed to be doing it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, we being Violet and I, found that we were pretty good at it. And we've, by good fortune or whatever, we've been able to keep our foundation going for just about 20 years now. And, I think we still have some level of influence in our field. And we still have some new and good ideas. We're still trying to, push the envelope here. And we'll just continue doing that.
I really loved what I read about the GPS, the watch that you're working on that can have a GPS, a long life GPS activated or battery operated locator for children. I think it's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, unfortunately, of all the things we're doing, that's the one that's not yet out on the marketplace, but hopefully it will be very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Impossible to cut off or impervious or... I just find that that's great.
It's a great idea. Absolutely.
It is.
And Mark, what are you doing tomorrow on Fox and Friends at 7:20 in the morning? What's that about?
Well, the premise is that there was a girl that was kidnapped a couple of months ago in Amarillo, Texas, and she escaped from a home in Lubbock, Texas, about 6 weeks later. And so basically there's going to be a series of questions surrounding what do you tell your kids, how do you keep them from getting abducted, what can they do to mitigate their situation once they've been taken, et cetera, et cetera. So it should be a good discussion.
I saw a statistic, Mark, that said 100,000 plus children a year go missing. Is that accurate?
No, it's not accurate. Actually, about 800,000, 800 plus thousand are reported missing every year. That includes all kinds of missing persons, but missing kids, but kids that are reported missing to law enforcement. So that includes the so-called stranger abduction, family abduction, runaways, throwaway children, and kids missing under suspicious circumstances. Yeah, the numbers are way more alarming. Over 800,000, that's right.
I can't even wrap my head around that.
I know.
Yes, it's crazy. But
how does the media determine which cases get attention? I can't quite understand that.
Well, I mean, the ones that get attention are pretty white girls, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
One
thing I've noticed, too, if you look at most of the missing children that get all the publicity, they have some sort of backstory. It's not just a normal family, with mom and dad who work hard or whatever. There's always some twisted, weird, boyfriend or some bizarre situation going on, a nasty divorce. There's some backstory that the media can put their teeth into, and it's wrong, but it's truth. That's just every kidnapping case you see, they have these weird things surrounding the child.
Well, that and or...
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, that and or there's a family member out there fiercely advocating on their behalf.
There you go.
I mean,
they have a mouthpiece that can get out there and get the attention they need. You're right.
Sure.
Mark, does your foundation reach out to these families, or do they come to you, or a mixture of both?
No, families that we help come to us. In every instance, they come to us. We need to be notified. We need to be contacted by either family members or law enforcement before we'll get involved in a case.
Mark, why don't you give the website where people can go, and you are a 501(c) charity. Donations are always welcome, so give us your website and give us your final thoughts, please.
Well, thank you very much. The website is classkids.org, KLAASKIDS. We are a nonprofit. Donations are tax deductible. We could use as many donations as we can get. It's always difficult raising money, and we've been probably spending too much time on that this year. And my final thoughts are that you do a great service, Tricia, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you and work with you.
Thank you. Give Violet my love.
You and the Web Sleuthers. The Web Sleuthers are very cool people. I've always appreciated the support we've received from them.
They are amazing. It's an amazing group of people from all over the world. Mark Class, thank you very much for coming on. It's always a pleasure and a joy talking with you. You take care, okay?
Okay, you too, Tricia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kimster, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
And I can hear you. And Michael, are you there?
I'm here, my darling.
Okay, Kimster, your thoughts on Mark Class and what he said.
I absolutely adore Mark Class, as you know. Class Kids is my personal favorite crime fighting charity. So I'm really glad that you mentioned that. They can always use help, because it's not free to go out to these places to help these families and to help find these missing children. And he has, whenever I try to think about how to do it right, you look at Mark Class. I mean, he has he knows his stuff, and he is definitely the one to call in times of trouble. I wanted to add, too, he was talking about the three strikes law. I wasn't really in knowing that much about crime or anything, but for a period of time, I lived in the Fresno, California area. And actually, this three strikes law came out of a case there, and I cannot remember her last name, but her first name was Kimber. If you Google mm-hmm. Kimber in Fresno, California, it was actually her family that started the idea of the three strikes law. And I remember that going on when I was in Fresno. They had it in the news a lot because he was there advocating it in that area. And what a great law. It just breaks my heart to know that my old home state has now retracted that law. It is truly a shame. Crime was horrendous back there. Mm-hmm. I was actually afraid to drive anywhere. And there was a gal that was going through a drive-thru at a Wendy's and got shot in the stomach for no reason. I mean, it was just nuts. Geez. And this girl, actually what happened to her was she had been murdered by a man that was trying to steal her purse in Fresno. She was a young girl. He had many felonies on him and should have mm-hmm. never been out. And he shot her when she tried to keep her purse is what she was trying to do. So if somebody tried to grab your purse, let them have it. Let him have it.
It's not worth it.
Because he killed her because she tried to fight for her purse.
Well, what's sad, Kimster, is the people of California in the next year or two, they're going to see the crime rate start going up, and they're going to go, what can we do? Well, what happens is when you don't have the bad guys behind bars, this is what happens. You know, they had the gang leaders. They had the really bad guys. They got them. And that's why crime was going down, and now it's not going to work. Kimster, before I go to Michael, I want to ask you, how was your vacation from Trisha's True Crime Radio? Did you miss us?
Yes, it's been so busy. You know, I know I've had a lot of people ask me where I've been. For anybody that has adult children, let me just say, my son just graduated from the University of Oregon. Yay, go Ducks. Mm-hmm. And he moved, his roommate lived in Colorado, and he moved back home with his parents. And my son moved back home, and he's staying here. He's got a summer job till he finds a career job. But, you know, because he was in college, he didn't have a car and all that. So anyway, I've just been, you know, wrapped up in another transition. And for mm-hmm. those of you who have little kids, or maybe you have somebody that just graduated from high school, and you're like, oh, my baby's gone. No, your baby's not gone. Okay?
They'll be back. They'll be back.
Oh, yeah. And there's still so many life events, and each one of them is precious. And I put my kids first, their priority. In fact, last night his band played, and I went and listened to that. And, you know, mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons I didn't come one of the nights here, because his band was playing. So put your kids first, you guys. I mean, I'm sure Mark Klass would tell everybody right now that every moment he had with Polly was precious, and mm-hmm. he just wished that he would have spent more time, and I'm sure he spent a lot. He's one of the best dads in the world. But, yeah, just remember that, and that's where my priority is. And I'm sorry, Trisha. If you were my daughter, I would have been here every Sunday.
That's okay. I'll let it pass this time. So we just know that you were missed and loved, and I had lots of mistakes, and I still blame them on you, even though you weren't here. So you still got the
blame. Well, you should
blame
them on Michael, because he's the guy.
Well, I did that, too.
You always blame it on the guy. Oh, okay.
That's true. I did that, too, for both of you. Kimster, it's wonderful to have you back. Absolutely wonderful.
Well, thank you.
And you'll be back next week. There's nothing coming up that you know of, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. Late Friday night, my son came home and said, you know, I have a gig tomorrow night. So, you know, I don't know.
It could be.
Yeah, as far as I know, nothing's going on next Sunday.
Okay. And Michael, my darling, great, great questions again. Thank you so much. What did you think of Mr. Klass?
Oh, I loved him. You know, I wanted to talk to him a bit more about some of the statistics I had seen about the crime rate in California, where there were 300,000 violent crimes, and after the three strikes law was implemented, it was halved. The crime rate was halved, and I thought that was phenomenal. And
it
now
is.
We're seeing crime rates already escalate.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was most curious about was the reclassification of what is what they consider to be a violent crime. One of the things that was glaring to me was assault with a deadly weapon is not considered a violent crime anymore in California.
What?
How is that possible?
That can't
be.
Oh, my
goodness.
No.
Yeah, I just read it.
So what do they call it? An assault with a deadly weapon is just a way to get your attention. It's not anything violent. They just want to make
sure
you know they're there.
Yeah, I really wanted to ask him that, and of course
I'm sorry.
Forgot it, but anyway.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah, I think
he did have to go.
Nuts.
Yeah, he had an obligation he had to get to, so I had to let him go. California is nuts. I mean, that's just crazy. How do you declassify an attack with a deadly weapon, assault with a deadly weapon, as not being oh my God, don't even get me started. I can't even, I'm all tongue-tied. I can't even talk about it.
Well, thank you
for
sending me
off.
Well, yeah, they're
I'm
changing
sorry.
The words around the meanings that have gone on forever too,
mm-hmm.
and they're it's like they're desensitizing or something. I don't know, but I was even told the other day they're going to change the wording for pork chops. And it's
they
like,
are?
Why are they changing? It was in the news here, around here locally. They're going to change it. You're not going to call them pork chops pretty soon. It's not going to be called pork chops. It's going to be called like something steak or some stupid thing. And they said they're doing it to make it easier to recognize your meat. And it's like, well, don't we all know what a pork chop is, for crying out loud? But sometimes I wonder if they're trying to desensitize these things. And then, you know, they, I don't know. I don't know, Michael. But I'm with you. What the heck is going on? I don't know.
I can't understand it for the life of me. And I can't understand the bill of goods. There's so much I don't understand, Trish, as you know. But the world is upside down. When our Constitution provides all these rights to the worst of the worst, and
mm-hmm.
victims don't have rights, this is a travesty that has to be addressed.
It is. It's an upside down world. It's, you know, we've fallen through the hole. We're, you know, in the looking glass. We're Alice in Wonderland. Everything is upside down. And if you go back in time, I mean, you can go back to, you know, 1,000 years and you'll hear Greek philosophers talking about how things are crazy and the youth of today doesn't respect their elders, saying the exact same things that we say now. But I'm telling you, it just seems like it's getting worse and worse. I have said, I understand Michael Jackson keeping his kids inside. I don't want to let my son go outside. I get it. It's scary. It's just crazy out there. And, but we have to live in this society, and as productive members of society, I believe we do have a responsibility to help out where we can. And I don't know where that is. Maybe, Michael, you need to head up the constitutional drive to get the Constitution, that amendment added. Maybe that's your thing. What do you think?
I wish I knew how. I would take it on. Like he said, Mark gave me the advice to talk to one of my state representatives or senators
mm-hmm.
or someone, and I think I will. I'll actually start that. That's a good thing to get behind, because it's
got
to
be
done.
Who would not vote for it? You've got to, you know, there'd just be some crazy Looney Tunes not vote for it. And I'm with you, Michael. I'm a bleeding heart left-wing liberal to a point, but I think that you can sit in your ivory tower and make all kinds of judgments, but until you get down and dirty in there fighting with the crime victims, you see a whole different thing. And there's a difference between wanting to help people who really need help and could really use help, and helping people that will do nothing but harm you, that have nothing to offer society. Those people need to be put away or put down, whatever you want to call it. And
absolutely,
you know,
they're not worthy of the charity that's being granted them.
Exactly.
It's appalling to me.
I wanted to say, I thought about this when you guys were talking about that, Michael, about contacting your representative, and Mark's answer about, you know, they'll kind of, you know, wave you off and give you some kind of an excuse. Try your local government, too. I don't know, you know, what kind of an area you're in, if you're in a county area or a city area. If you're in a city area with a police department, that's really good, because you can go to all your city council meetings, get a flavor for what's going on, because it's a lot easier to vote out people from the local government, and that will start sending a message to the upper government if the local government start changing, because, you know, a lot of cities have their own police departments, and you can change your laws right there in your town a lot easier than you can contacting a state or federal representative.
Interesting. See, I never would have thought of that. That's very good advice, Kimster. That's very good advice. Okay, well, I think we'll, I'll tell you what, let's meet here next week. Let's see how we change the world in 7 days, and maybe everything will be fixed. Okay, you guys, I'm telling you, I feel like a giant garden slug that has had salt poured on it. I am just melting here. So I have got to say goodnight because I need to go dunk my head. I'm going to go dunk my head in water and then stick it in a freezer. And then I think I might cool down. So, Kimster, I hope you'll be back with us next week. But if your kidlets have something they need their mom for, we totally understand. But do try, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. And, Michael, you know I love and adore you. Everybody does. Thank you for all of your sharp questions. And like I said, you always say what everybody else is thinking, and that's what I love about you. You're coming back next week, right?
Hopefully, yep.
Hopefully, you better be here. It'll be big trouble. You'll get a cut and pay, young man. That's all I can say. Okay, kids, it's Trisha's True Crime Radio, and I do have to read this legal goo. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. And do remember this, Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get upset, my darling little angel, that something you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, you come to me or come to the person who said it. Do not take it out on the forums. Come to me, and we'll try and make you happy. That's our goal. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.